philosophische Brocken auf Orange 94.0 und im Internet unter http://audiothek.philo.at.
Schönen Nachmittag bei einer Folge der philosophischen Brocken. Begrüßt Sie Herbert Rachowitz. Vor einem Monat gab es hier eine Sendung, die den Titel getragen hat, Offenheit ist eine schwierige Tugend. Sie war gestaltet von Andreas Kirchner und hat sich beschäftigt mit der Dokumentation von Vorträgen, Diskussionen auf einem Symposium Paraflows Open Cultures. In diesen Diskussionen ist es unter anderem darum gegangen, dass der Terminus Offenheit, der ja im Großen und Ganzen positiv konnotiert ist, seine Tücken hat, kann man sagen. Und die spezielle Schwierigkeit, über die ich in einem Vortrag berichtet habe, war bezogen auf Open Access. Open Access, die Bewegung, die dafür eintritt, dass wissenschaftliche Literatur am Netz kostenfrei für alle zugänglich ist und damit die dominante Position, die Verlage mit immer höheren Geldforderungen ausnützen, in einer Weise unterlaufen wird. Das Beispiel, um zu zeigen, dass es sich um eine schwierige Tugend handelt, war ein spezielles Open Access Journal. Es hat sich nämlich mehr oder weniger beiläufig gezeigt, dass wenn man durchaus in Universitätsbibliothekskatalogen recherchiert, man auf Zeitschriften trifft, die offen zugänglich sind, die also alle guten Eigenschaften haben, die man sich so wünscht, die aber hinterrücks eigentlich Projekte zum Abcashen sind, die ohne jede Qualitätskontrolle hauptsächlich darauf eingestellt sind, Geld zu verlangen von den Autorinnen, um etwas unterzubringen in einem solchen Journal. Ein spezielles Beispiel, das ich gebracht habe, war das sogenannte International Journal of Computer Science and Engineering, das in Indien herausgegeben worden ist, also IGCSE, von dem man sagen kann, dass es noch kaum je eine derartig schlampige Politik der Edition und der Kontrolle der mitgelieferten Inhalte gegeben hat, wie in diesem Journal exemplifiziert. Ich habe in der weiteren Folge dann noch ein bisschen nachgegoogelt im Zusammenhang mit IGCSE und bin auf sehr eigenartige Phänomene gestoßen, nämlich es gibt dieses Akronym IGCSE zumindest dreimal und es heißt einmal International Journal on Computer Sciences and Engineering, das andere Mal International Journal of Computer Science and Engineering und ein drittes Journal heißt Indian Journal of Computer Science and Engineering. Was haben diese Journals gemeinsam? Sie haben dieselbe Webmaske und sie haben zusammen mit einer ganzen Reihe anderer derartiger Journals eine bemerkenswerte Kontinuität im Editionsteam. Ein Herr Sivakumar und ein Herr Selvi wechseln sich in unterschiedlichen Funktionen in allen diesen Journalen als Herausgeber ab. Das nur als ein kleines Beispiel für Schwierigkeiten, in die man hineingerät. Man kommt, um den Fachausdruck zu nennen, auf das Phänomen der sogenannten Predatory Journals, also Trittbrettfahrer, wenn man so will, die sich anhängen an die Popularität dieses Begriffs Offenheit, um ihre eigenen Finanzen an der Stelle zu sanieren. Ich möchte in dieser Sendung weitere Aspekte in diesem Themenkreis und Problembereich ansprechen, wobei ich durchaus darauf hinweise, dass das eine zwiespältige Geschichte ist, dass es hochqualitative, hochmotivierte Journals gibt, die offen ihre Inhalte anbieten und eine wesentliche Bereicherung des wissenschaftlichen Feldes darstellen. Es geht aber darum, hier Licht- und Schattenseiten gleichzeitig zu sehen. Und in diesem Zusammenhang geht es jetzt in dieser Sendung nicht mehr um Journals, sondern ich möchte zwei Themen ansprechen, die damit verbunden sind. Das eine bezieht sich direkt auch auf Internetaktivitäten und das andere bezieht sich mehr auf den politischen Bereich. Die Internetaktivitäten, die ich jetzt als erstes diskutiere, die schließen an ein Manifest, das eben erschienen ist in der Herbstnummer der Zeitschrift Tumult. Tumult, eine Zeitschrift, die im Untertitel sich nennt eine Vierteljahrsschrift für Konsensstörung und die diesen Herbst ein Manifest bringt von einem nominellen Herrn Albert Kamp. Dieses Manifest nennt sich Charta der anonymen Akademiker. Nun hat es hier schon einen kleinen Spielfaktor mit drinnen, denn der Albert Kamp ist ein vorgeschützter Name, sein Pseudonym. Es wird angegeben, dass der Name des Verfassers der Redaktion bekannt ist. Es ist ein Wissenschaftler, der an einer bekannten deutschen Universität arbeitet. Und das Spiel, das damit getrieben wird, ist das, dass sich dieser Wissenschaftler nicht nennt, weil es ihm auch im Text, den er schreibt, um Anonymität geht. Und diese Anonymität, die er vertritt und verteidigt, gegen die Offenheit, die am Internet praktisch überall erwartet und praktiziert wird, ist eine Anonymität des Wissenschaftsbetriebs. Er beginnt mit der These, dass sich Wissenschaft mit dem Internet nicht verträgt und dass ein wesentlicher Grund dafür darin liegt, dass man in der Wissenschaft einen Schutzraum braucht, insbesondere auch für Forscherinnen, die erst vertraut werden mit dem Bereich. Es geht darum für ihn, dass man nicht sofort mit allen Dingen, die man hat, serienweise und so schnell als möglich in die Öffentlichkeit des Internets geht, um dort Aufmerksamkeit zu erwecken und Punkte zu sammeln. Diese Offenheit im Sinn von, es kann von allen aufgerufen werden und es wird registriert, diese Offenheit wäre der Wissenschaft nicht dienlich und stattdessen sollte man sich reserviert verhalten und Kompetenzen aufbauen in einem durchaus altmodischen Sinn. Er scheut sich nicht, zurückzurufen in Praktiken, die es mehr im 20. Jahrhundert gegeben hat als in unserer internetbeschleunigten Zeit. Und er spricht ganz speziell von einer Webplattform, die populär ist, Millionen von Benutzerinnen hat, nämlich Academia Edu. Er weist darauf hin, dass die, sagen wir mal, Eitelkeit von vielen Leuten darin bedient wird, dass man sich Seiten gestalten kann, die das eigene Profil entsprechend hervorkehren und dass auf diese Art und Weise die Wissenschaftlerinnen einsteigen in einen permanenten Wettbewerb, ein Ticker, der jedes einzelne Aufrufen einer Seite oder eines Artikels von solchen Leuten registriert. Und ich kann an der Stelle aus einer kursorischen Lektüre des Blogs eines Kollegen mitteilen, dass die Leute wirklich darauf reagieren und ganz geschmeichelt sind, wenn sie durch hausinterne Mitteilungen von Academia Edu darüber verständigt werden, dass sie ganz besonders oft angeklickt worden sind in ihren Darstellungen. Das würde, so Albert Kamp, die Wissenschaft ruinieren, geschützte Orte zerstören und die wissenschaftliche Urteilsfähigkeit, die ja nun wirklich nicht darauf beruht, dass international möglichst viele Leute auf einen Button klicken, einigermaßen untergraben. Also auch ein Aspekt der Schwierigkeit für Offenheit zu plädieren. Dazu muss man auch noch sagen, dass der Gründer von Academia Edu, ein Mr. Price, ganz ungeniert verkündet hat und niedergelegt hat, das lässt sich nachlesen, dass die Geschäftsidee von Academia Edu, für die er Startkapital von Private Equity Firms bekommen hat, also Kapitalbeteiligungsgesellschaften, die Geschäftsidee ist die, möglichst alles, was in der Wissenschaft passiert, hineinzusaugen in diesen Datenbereich, damit dann Trends extrapoliert werden können, die man verkaufen kann. Monetarized ist sein Ausdruck, also da gibt es gar keine Umschweife. Man kann sie verkaufen zum Beispiel an Berufungskommissionen, die gerne wissen würden, wer gerade der Shootingstar in einem bestimmten Bereich ist. Man kann Berufsvermittlung betreiben, man kann zum Beispiel großen Firmen Informationen zur Verfügung stellen, wohin bestimmte Forschungszweige tendieren, sodass sie sich in ihrer Firmenstrategie danach ausrichten können. Und die Lock-Methode, mit der es gelingen soll, Wissenschaftlerinnen dazu zu bringen, ihre Daten zur Verfügung zu stellen, ist eben die Offenheit der Profilpräsentation zusammen mit den einhergehenden Hin und Wieder Informationen darüber, wie viele Leute sich interessieren für die jeweilige Person, was im Nebensatz gesagt ein ganz triviales Unternehmen ist. Man schneidet sowieso sämtlichen Webverkehr mit den Logfiles mit und extrahiert aus den Logfiles dann die jeweiligen Events, die damit zu tun haben, dass eine bestimmte Person das und das anbietet. Also ein Unternehmen insgesamt, bei dem man sich doppelt und dreifach fragen müsste, was eigentlich die Werteabwägung zwischen dem Faktor der Öffentlichkeit und dem Faktor des ein bisschen zurückgenommeneren Agierens ist. Vor allem auch, um hier ein letztes dazu zu sagen, wenn man liest in den Benutzungsbedingungen für Academia Edu, dass sich diese Website das Recht vorbehält, alles, was an Inhalten in diese Website eingegeben wird, nach eigenem Ermessen zu kürzen, zu modifizieren, darzustellen, zu streichen und wie immer. Es betrifft nicht die Eigentumsrechte an den jeweiligen Inhalten, die bleiben bei der Benutzerin, aber was immer mit diesen eingereichten Dingen in Academia Edu gemacht wird, liegt ausschließlich in der Kompetenz der Sitebetreiber. Was, wenn man das Kolleginnen und Kollegen sagt, doch eine ziemliche Bedenklichkeit erzeugen würde, wenn sie denn die Benutzungsbedingungen lesen und sich klar darüber werden, worauf sie sich da einlassen. Das war der Teil zum akademischen Offenheitsproblem. Jetzt komme ich zum zweiten Teil, der ein politischer sein wird und in dem der Schwerpunkt auf einem Interview liegen wird, das ich mit Michael Dahan geführt habe, diesen Sommer im Rahmen eines Symposions in Oslo. Michael Dahan, ein israelischer Forscher, der in einem College an der Nähe des Gazastreifens, Sapir College, unterrichtet, Soziologe, Politologe, und der einen Vortrag gehalten hat über Transparenz. Transparenz, ganz offensichtlich benachbart mit diesem Thema Offenheit und ausgerichtet, das ist eines der Zitate, mit dem Michael Dahan in seinem Vortrag begonnen hat, ausgerichtet auf ein Zitat von einem US-amerikanischen obersten Gerichtshofrichter, Brandeis, der gesagt hat, das Sonnenlicht ist das beste Desinfektionsmittel. Also Licht hineinbringen, ein Aufklärungsmotiv, Licht in die Sache bringen, führt dazu, dass das Dunkel vergeht, dass man sich nicht mehr verstecken kann, dass alles für Urteile und Diskussionen offen liegt, dass eine Publizität erreicht wird, die der Demokratie letztlich nützt und nur nützen kann. Und hier ist die Besonderheit des Vortrags von Michael Dahan wiederum die, dass diese Transparenz, die ganz sicherlich an vielen Stellen wünschenswert ist, dass die auch Schattenseiten hat. Dass man auch darauf hinweisen muss, dass Transparenz unerwünschte Nebeneffekte hat, wenn man das so sagen will. Und ein Bereich, in dem man das vielleicht in österreichischen Zusammenhang gut ermessen kann, ist die Plagiatsfrage. Also Plagiate werden von den selbst so sich bezeichnenden Plagiatsjägern auf die Art und Weise propagiert, dass man sagt, hier muss man gegen Dummheit, gegen Desinteresse, gegen falsche angesetzte Verteidigung Licht in die Dinge bringen und die wirklichen Umstände enthüllen. Das ist ein schönes Beispiel für die Doppelheit von wünschenswert und nicht so sinnvoll im Zusammenhang mit Offenheit, denn auf diese Art und Weise gerät man in einen Grenzbereich zwischen dem, was die Wissenschaft zu beurteilen hat und dem, was die Schlagzeilen bedeuten und was die Schlagzeilen produzieren. Es ist sicher richtig, dass Wissenschaft versagt, immer wieder versagen kann. Speziell in dem Fall Plagiate gibt es manifest solche Missgeschicke und Unterlassungen, die man durchaus scharf kritisieren kann. Es ist aber der Grenzbereich erreicht, wenn es darum geht, dass man an die Wissenschaft durch Enthüllungsstrategien, durch publikumswirksame Schlagzeilen eine Forderung und einen Druck anlegt, der in einem gewissen Spannungsverhältnis zu dem steht, was die Wissenschaft tun kann. Es stehen sich also gegenüber die beiden Momente, einerseits die Insuffizienz der Wissenschaft, angesichts derer man nach äußeren Mitteln suchen kann und suchen möchte, um hier auf die Wissenschaft verbesserungsweise verbessernd einzugreifen, und auf der anderen Seite die Überlegung, was wird an dieser Stelle an Aufmerksamkeit, Emotionen und negativen Potenzial angesprochen, gibt es damit nicht auch Folgeschäden. Im Einzelnen müsste man das natürlich jeweils eigens abwägen. Ich habe das nur als Beispiel gebracht, um einzuleiten, was der Bereich ist, in dem Michael Dahan dieses Thema anspricht. Und das ist ein Bürgerkomitee, das nennt sich Social Guard und ist ein im Gefolge der Demonstrationen in Israel 2011. Es ging damals um die überhöhten Wohnungs- und Hauspreise. Es gab monatelange, sehr eindringliche Demonstrationen gegen die Politik der Regierung. Im Gefolge dieser Initiative ist Social Guard gegründet worden als eine NGO, die sich damit beschäftigt, die Abläufe in der Gesetzgebung, in der Knesset wahrzunehmen und öffentlich zu dokumentieren über Facebook und über Twitter. Also ein Unternehmen, von dem man instinktiv mal sicherlich sagt, das zahlt sich aus, das ist gut, das hätten wir gerne gehabt, wenn es um Hypoalpe Adria gegangen wäre, hätte man mehr gewusst von den Kontobewegungen unseres ehemaligen Finanzministers, wäre uns einiges erspart geblieben. Also es fällt schwer, hier nicht zu sagen, das ist in Ordnung. Gleichzeitig aber, und da steckt ein Haken, und das ist auch die Schwierigkeit, auf die ich in dieser Sendung hinweisen möchte, gleichzeitig spricht Michael Dahan einige sehr bedenkenswerte Worte der Warnung und der Kritik aus gegen diese Form von Selbst eingesetzten Transparenzinitiativen. Der wichtigste Punkt, den ich jetzt mal vorausnehme, um auch zu orientieren, worum es dann und wohin es dann in diesem Gespräch geht. Der wichtigste Punkt ist, dass eine populistische Note, die genau mit Skandalen, mit Empörung zu tun hat, ein wichtiges Motiv dafür ist. Michael Dahan zitiert in seinem Referat Berichte, die dann aus den jeweiligen Komitees der Knesset kommen und die so beginnen, dass man sagt, 3 Stunden bin ich da drinnen gesessen und das ist alles Bullshit. Es setzen sich freiwillige Bürgerinnen in diese Beratungen rein und wundern sich darüber, wie sonderbar das ist, wie wenig zur Sache das geht und wie sehr man eigentlich sagen muss, auf den ersten Blick, hier hat uns unsere Demokratie verlassen, da geht es nur mehr um Einzelprobleme, die man nicht überschaut, es geht nicht um das, was uns direkt betrifft. Das ist ein gutes Rezept dafür, Aufmerksamkeit zu wecken, und es ist in der gegenwärtigen Situation von Demokratien abzusehen, dass es ein Spiel mit der Komplexität und Komplexitätsreduktion ist, in der eine heutige Volkswirtschaft notgedrungen steht. Und es ist immer auch ein Spiel mit der Mobilisierung von Negativität. Das ist ein Punkt, der von Michael Dahan auch noch so dargestellt wird, dass er sagt, es geht hier nicht um politisches Engagement. Die Träger der Social Guard betrachten sich explizit als nicht politisch. Sie schauen nur zu, sie machen nur transparent, sie lassen da nur das Licht hinein. Das ist die vorgebliche Aktion, die sie tun. In Wirklichkeit mobilisieren sie aber ein Ressentimentpotenzial der Bevölkerung gegen eine sowieso schon angeschlagene Demokratie. Die soll hier nicht glorifiziert werden, es soll nur darauf hingewiesen werden, dass diese Offenheit an der Stelle auch einen unerwünschten Faktor mit sich bringt. Hören Sie jetzt das Interview mit Michael Dahan in Englisch.
So the term you just used was the dark side of transparency. Now, which is an obvious contrast to sunlight being the best disinfectant. So can you tell us a bit about Brandeis and this?
Well, the concept in American, certainly in American democracy, but also in liberal thinking, is that the more transparency, the more things are open, the less chance there is of corruption, hidden decisions, deals being made in back rooms, etc., etc., etc.
WikiLeaks, of course.
WikiLeaks, Snowden, to a certain extent, but those come from the bottom. And usually when we talk about transparency, we're talking about government transparency. But more and more, because of technology, and this was reasonable. I think we had a balance before the expansion of the use of all sorts of technologies that provide total transparency. Because we have no privacy anymore. I mean, everything we do is transparent. We can't even lose ourselves in a large crowd these days.
So you mean this is a dramatic change in the circumstances of how we are perceiving ourselves as political entities. Since I've been mentioning WikiLeaks, it occurs to me that the way the newspapers actually dealt with WikiLeaks is an interesting one. Because according to transparency and to maximum transparency, what should have happened, of course, is all those transactions would have to be made available to the public as is, with no comments, nothing blacked out.
Right, no mediation.
No mediation, mm-hmm. And this would have meant the maximum of truth. So in some way there is this idea that if you get as close as you can possibly get to those transactions, you will know the most of it,
right.
the most of that. Now, this is not the case in some way, and I think your point would be that it was not just prudent, but also professional and right for democracy to filter these sort of informations. I mean, what happened is you had those big newspapers, and the big newspapers, they tried to separate off stuff that was too dangerous, even if true was too dangerous, but also stuff that was misleading and stuff that was possible, for example, to incite violence.
And I also think that Assange was very, very careful about what he released as well, because he only, if you look at what's available from WikiLeaks, because there's more there that we haven't seen. He only released on certain countries. For example, South America. There's very little on South America. There's very little on Russia. So he also sort of filtered what was coming out. And I don't know. You know, it's not clear to me what his agenda is.
Yeah.
In that sense, why it was filtered. And you're absolutely right that the papers also took a chunk. I think part of it was prudency. Yeah. Okay, I'm not arguing that the transparency is a horrible thing, but that we have to understand the total effect or the contextual effect of transparency. Even Snowden plays the game with his releases with the NSA documents, you know, to build up and make it into a media event each time, together with The Guardian and
the reason I mention this is that the main line of your argument goes something like this. We have this populist urge and intuition that we got as close as possible to the truth if we know it firsthand, all of it. Now, this gives rise to surveillance initiatives, people that actually sit there and report on that. And now your argument is that this is not beneficial, but actually destructive for democracy. Probably you would like to say a little bit more about this, why this is not beneficial to democracy.
Well, basically, if you overexpose things, if they're overexposed, then to a certain extent they lose their value. And I think that the public at large all over the world is very, very cynical. And people have a tendency to focus on the negative aspects of any kind of whistleblowing or exposure or surveillance or oversight. And it just feeds the cynicism. It feeds the political cynicism and this sort of like willingness to divorce yourself from the political.
And
or seeing the political is completely negative.
I was just expecting now to say yourself seeing the politicians completely naked.
Naked, yeah.
So your objection really is that there are paparazzi at work there in some way. They're sitting in the committees and they are doing paparazzi work.
Right.
And the reason for this is, of course, if I stick with paparazzis, they have their camera or their recording equipment, and they know nothing about the family. They don't know nothing about feelings. They don't know nothing about how a certain social set works. They want just want to get a glimpse of someone topless or whatever, or kissing or not kissing or fighting, and then they sell it to the public as the closest you get to what those persons really are.
Right.
And the analogy would be someone sitting in a parliamentary committee, not knowing about the law, not knowing about the sort of political considerations in the background, just reporting on surface procedures.
Mm-hmm.
With no knowledge of the background, and claiming that one gets closer to the truth by reporting on what one can simply hear.
Yeah, and I'm glad you used the analogy of a naked politician, because you know when transparency is usually described, so they say the claim is if you're going to be naked, then you better make sure you look good naked. Okay, but most people don't make sure that they look good naked, and it's not a natural inclination, and it won't be. And even politicians, whether good or bad in a normative sense, they deserve a certain degree of shadow or a gray area. I don't think that this total exposure or radical transparency, which did exist in Brandeis's time. I mean, if Brandeis said that sunlight is the best disinfectant, he had a different concept of transparency, and not this total transparency that in a sense maybe shatters things, and it's divorced from context as well.
Now, granted, this is a legitimate criticism, then of course there is a question you have to answer. Namely, what's the remedy? I mean, someone critical of your position would probably argue or ask you, want to know, are we to reintroduce censorship? So how are we going to deal with these instruments? Because we know, that the official pronouncements of the parliament, they are always in some way redacted, mm-hmm. and they try to make the best of it. There is this acute feeling that they don't tell you the truth.
They don't tell you the truth. They absolutely don't tell you the truth. And I've come, when I do research, say, I was conducting research with a colleague in Holland, and she was looking at a government decision regarding state propaganda in Israel. And it took me a while, but I got to the full text of the government decision. And one of the paragraphs, there was a star next to the number of the paragraph of the decision, you know, and I followed the star to the end of the document, and I see this is not the full text of this particular section. You can get the full text from the government, from the Prime Minister's secretary, okay, under certain conditions. Okay, now it was clear from the decision that this deals with security matters and sensitive issues. So while we're transparent, we're completely naked. The public, the citizens are completely naked, whether we look good naked or we don't look good naked. Mm-hmm. We're completely naked. The government says transparency, transparency, but they're very, very careful about what they release, and not necessarily in a good way. So, and I think we've developed this fetish for transparency. If you look at the reality shows, reality TV is, you know, it's a form of exposing ourselves and becoming transparent to the general public. Certainly shows like Big Brother and it creates a mindset for the public as well that transparency is a good thing. It's a positive thing.
So how do I convince someone that that he should not want to see me naked, but that the way I dress is the right way and is the best opportunity to know something about me. Because every time I dress, there will be this impression that I am trying to show off something, that that I will try to influence opinions about myself.
That's what people do every day. They get up and they put on makeup and they put on their clothes for
right.
whatever, if they're going to work or if
right.
they're going to play.
But then should we grant the simple the same privilege to an parliamentary committee? Because in a parliamentary committee, if you have a chairman and the chairman gives a press conference, and the press conference of a chairman is much like him wearing a suit and a nice tie and say, look, this is as nice as I am. And there is this urge to say, no, there must be something more, that you're hiding something.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's the reason why investigative journalism exists. And if you know that, that's disappearing as an art form, I guess, investigative journalism, real investigative journalism. So they're putting out press releases mm-hmm. and or rewriting press releases that they received and doing very little real journalism. No, I don't think, of course, that the parliamentary committee should be completely sub rosa, hidden from the public. But I think that we have to find a balance and that we have to reconsider what transparency means and who's really transparent and who's not. Because I think that the consequences for democracy could be quite quite fatal.
So who is going to do this work? I mean, if I understand you correctly, what you would like is to have a competent person listening in to those committees.
No, a
responsible and competent person which is able to be silent about some of the stuff that was actually transacted, and at the same time pointing out the important things.
Take for example the paper I gave today. If we take the Social Guard and we change the funding model on which they're based, right? Because basically they have to make the parliamentarians look bad in order to raise money, because otherwise it appears that they're not really doing anything. But if there was a different funding model where they weren't dependent on this on this kind of exposure, whether it even be from the state, saying, okay, and then things would be a little bit more balanced in terms of that. They wouldn't be saying, you know, they'd be focusing on the more, and in a responsible framework. No, I don't trust the government or a government censor, but a sort of an ombudsman or an ombudsman-like group that could be trusted, or a committee, would certainly make much more sense. But again, this is a slippery slope, and it's problematic.
Yeah.
I mean, if I look at the Israeli example, Up until the 90s, they had there was this institution called the Committee of Editors, and whenever the state wanted to hide something big, they would convene this committee of editors of the major newspapers and television stations and radio stations, and tell them the entire story, and then tell them, but please don't publish any of this. And up until the 90s, they agreed.
It worked.
Mm-hmm. They worked because it was convenient for the editors. They knew what was going on, yeah. So it gave them a feeling, a sense of power. Okay. And of course, it was convenient for the government because yeah. They had, they had some control over what would be leaked to the public or not. So yeah. I'm not advocating to go back to that to that sort of model. And in all fairness, it was the editors that, because of the internet, actually told the government, "We're not doing this anymore."
Okay. Yeah.
Because if the information is available anyway, and it might be coming, it might have been published in another country, and we might get it from another source. Then there's no reason for us to participate in this farce, the facade of cooperation. So I'm not suggesting to go back to that sort of model, but I think that there has to be a middle ground, between that and
one idea that strikes me in your presentation is there seems to be a self-destructive feature in our current democracy.
Yes.
And this self-destruction shows itself by this sensationalist streak where you have to uncover, where you have to tear away the veils in order to get at how things are really are. And this urge is quite often, as you quoted, combined with expression of disgust. That's bullshit. That's not what we want to. Those are not reasonable people. They do something else. And this in the service of democracy, or what do those people think?
They're convinced that they're contributing to Israeli democracy. I mean, they're really convinced that they're there. I mean, they call themselves the guard. You know, the wall between the collapse of the wall before the barbarians. Attack the gates and. It's a very pretentious position, of course.
Now, you have briefly been mentioning that even the state could consider to establish some ombudsman or something like this, actually paying for this sort of neutral reports, because it would be a service
to the public.
To the public.
Okay, but you have to be, the government, of course, has to be committed to that. I mean, they do have to be committed to a certain degree of transparency. Okay, if you look, for example, at the freedom of information laws in most countries, most democratic countries have freedom of information laws or freedom of information acts, but many of them also put great barriers to actually accessing the information. So either you have to pay a certain amount of money to access the information, either the requests get lost, or supposedly lost, or they're refused for security or national security reasons and stuff like that. And we see this in almost every Western democracy, and there's this constant tension going on. But it's also part of the political culture of each country in terms of how they see themselves to be exposed. I think Scandinavian countries, for example, are more willing to expose the inner workings. But it has to be balanced. I mean, you can't focus just on the failures, just on the picantery, the spicy issues. And you also have to say, you know, it wouldn't hurt every now and then to say some of the members of Knesset are doing, or of a parliament, any parliament, are doing a good job. They're working hard. I mean, and they are working hard. Yeah. Not everyone in government is corrupt. Not everyone.
So the research that you have been reporting today is part of a larger agenda, which has to do with the crisis of democracy in a more general way. And could you talk a bit about what else is interesting for you in this circumstance?
Well, basically what we've been doing for the past year and a half or so is trying to look at the issues, the crisis of democracy, which is primarily a crisis of legitimacy and representation. We feel that's one of the main reasons why people took to the streets, especially the young people. Very little economic future, certainly in the States where students are finishing university with $100,000, $200,000 of debt on their back. Unemployed, they have no way of paying back these loans. The same thing is happening in many, many countries. Students finish their degrees and they go out into the market and there's either very little work and they don't feel that they're being represented or their voices are being heard. At the same time, we also have severe crisis of legitimacy, of public trust in almost all liberal democracies. And what we started out doing was asking what role does technology have to play in this, and whether without falling into the trap of technological determinism. In other words, we're not claiming that it's technology that's brought us here, but perhaps the failure of modernism, the fact that modernism hasn't fulfilled its promise to the people, and the new messiah in that sense is technology. And technology will provide transparency. Technology will allow us to participate. Technology will make us, you know, will make our lives better. DuPont, the chemical company, used to have a saying in the 60s, better living through chemistry. Okay? Yeah. This promise of that modernism gave to us of a better life and a better society, and it hasn't really played out the way people had hoped. And we feel that this poses an extreme threat to democracy. What we'll be looking at next and trying to tie this all together is how big data plays into all of this. Because on one hand, you could claim that the fact that you can aggregate data from millions of people, okay, government data, personal data, public information, okay, technically you can take that information and you can know how each individual citizen would vote in a particular situation, in a particular election. You know what policies they support. The same way you know what toothpaste they use or what kind of toilet paper or bath soap. Yeah. Our fear is that this would free the citizens of even feeling the need to participate in the democratic game or the political game, right? They could be able to send their digital selves, their digital footprint or digital fingerprint, okay, with all of their worldviews or approximated worldviews and people would claim that this is the most democratic possibility, right? Because if everything's out there and the government knows and they can work that out, or an agency, even if it's an independent agency, knows how we feel on political issues, then we don't even need to participate. But that's a true democracy because they can even anticipate what will interest us future.
I wonder what big data would have to say to the situation in the Ukraine, for example. I mean, one is also so accustomed to just take the best cases and worry about them. But if one takes a situation like the Ukraine or Iraq or any stuff like this, it becomes quite obvious that you can amass an enormous amount of data, which will not help you.
You're absolutely right. Because I think
predict in which way the politics of this will work out.
Yeah. Well, first I heard a lecture which I found ridiculous, and I can't remember where it was. Where some people are claiming that they actually were able to predict the Arab Spring on the basis of big data and a few parameters. I find this very hard to believe. I doubt this very much, and there's a huge problem also with the collection of data in Arab countries. This is more of a threat in democratic countries because it's important to stress that in democratic societies, we're under more surveillance than they are than people are in authoritarian societies. Oddly enough.
Serious, yes?
Yeah, I mean that seriously. Because if you look at authoritarian societies, usually the private sector is very, very small and underdeveloped. Okay, they're not collecting data on the citizens. Okay, mm-hmm. They don't care.
And they hide. They won't have supermarket
exactly. chips
and
like
honor
cards.
They will refuse that.
Exactly. Yeah. So the only body really collecting information is the state, and yes, they can be quite effective as that, but not as effective when you have two primary sectors in a society, because most of our interactions are within the private sector, not within the public sector. So it's when you match these two together that you have this basis of data, which is astounding. So in that sense, we claim that we're under more surveillance in democratic societies. And it's more of a threat than you are in non-democratic societies.
But again, what is the remedy? Or what would you like? What situation would you prefer? How to react to this analysis?
Well, we have to be very, very careful about implementing big data within political frameworks.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's a good idea maybe to know how people feel in a certain neighborhood in a certain city about new streetlights or how the street should be paved or where there should be public transportation stops or what time they should take out the garbage or collect the garbage in the morning or in the evening and schools and things like that. But the hunger, the temptation to be able to predict everything, okay, and we can see it today. We see it today with predictive policing. So, I mean, essentially, I'm not sure if it was you or somebody. No, I think it was Andrew Feinberg that said that, well, it's profiling under a different name, under a more scientific name. But that's exactly what it is. So you're also using this data, which is supposed to be impartial, right, because it's just data. Mm-hmm. Okay, to support a practice that's been going on unofficially and actually go to people's homes, go to people's places of work and tell them, you know, your name came up by the computer and we're very worried that in the next couple of days you're going to be involved in a serious crime. Really, this is going on. This has gone on in Chicago. They're using it in Los Angeles. And
that's real?
This is real life.
Oh.
Okay, now, on the other hand, if we're talking about transparency, then I want to see the algorithm
of course
that the Chicago police are using or the Los Angeles police are using in order to reach these conclusions and to send squad cars to a certain block because they know that there's a potential, there's a 70% or 80% potential of violence or riots or any kind of manifestation like that. Okay, but we can't see the algorithms. These are all held privately, so... Again, we're more transparent than the agencies that we're supposedly overseeing and are supposed to serve us. And that's our fear, is that more and more... And this will be convenient because the public will say, well, look, it's technology. It's science. Yeah. It's impartial.
The problem, of course, is also that those people who are supposed to decide about these issues, like the parliamentary representatives... they are as clueless sometimes as we ourselves are. So that there is a circle. I wonder which kind of circle it is, namely that people who don't know enough are going to decide on stuff that has some very serious and negative consequences. And since they don't really know how this works, it makes things even worse.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, it's quite obvious, for example, in the law system in Austria or Germany, when judges had to rule on complicated IT matters with no idea at all what was really involved, and now you had suddenly the stamp of the law on issues and on laws that were clearly non-professional, that were clearly articulated with no knowledge about this, which made things even worse.
Yeah. And that frequently in fact, I reached that same conclusion about a year ago, and I tried to establish a program for judges in Israel with people from computer science and political science that would sit down with them and talk about the implications and the meanings of certain technologies and of course, lawyers, right? So it would be in a legal framework as well for exactly those purposes, because they're making decisions and they're setting precedents on things that they don't completely understand or aren't aware of the consequences, the future consequences. Because I think we're poised right before an age of something like the Minority Report. But it won't be these muses that do preventive policing or predictive policing. It'll be computers based on algorithms with decisions made by legislators and judges that don't completely understand the information or the implications of these kinds of technologies.
So one conclusion would be one still has. To accept that one is a finite, fallible being, which at the same time, even so, one is fallible and finite and deficient, has to decide some stuff without knowing all about the circumstances, mm-hmm. There's an element of risk. There's a huge element of risk. And one would have to be trained to be able to stand this element of risk, because one of the arguments for big data, of course, is to reduce or minimize the amount of risk.
Right, yeah. And in some areas it's important and it works. Epidemiology, medicine, even the fact that the health service organizations will call you up at a certain age once you reach a certain age and suggest you do certain tests. All of this based on statistical data and other elements. I mean, if you go back to the beginning of big data or how statistics was used in that sense, you have to go back to London. 150 years ago, 160 years ago, with a cholera outbreak in London. And a doctor that decided that he wanted to map, he began to map where people were sick. The districts where they were sick to try and get to ground zero where the cholera broke out. And he took this information, which was valid information, to the city leaders, and he said, look, there's a problem here. My guess is that it's this pump, this water pump in a certain area. Which saved a lot of lives. But they didn't listen to him.
No?
He locked it himself. He destroyed it himself. He destroyed the pump himself.
Well, that's a case for a film. One could really make a thriller, from that.
He destroyed the pump himself,
And he saved lives.
No, he wasn't put to jail, but he saved lives.
Yeah.
So there is value in data and there is value in statistical analysis, but it has to be guided by a more gentler approach and not rely solely on technology, because more and more we've given up our ability to make decisions to technology. If we're driving in the car and the GPS tells us to turn left, okay, we turn left. There might be a wall when we turn left, right? But our instinct is to assume that the technology is neutral. It's not biased. It doesn't have any prejudices.
It's dependable.
Okay, it's dependable. It always works.
Yeah.
Okay, et cetera, et cetera. But we know that technology is not necessarily neutral. It's not necessarily unbiased. Okay, because it was programmed by individuals with their own biases, with their own political agendas. There is a great deal of politics within technology, but the public doesn't see it like that. They see it as being something neutral and cool.
Okay? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.